Ricardo Ortiz is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Stay with us as we discuss capital punishment and witness the legal homicide of Ricardo Ortiz in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Terry Epstein, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Human Hadayati, a leader in students against the death penalty. The Execution Watch begins.
This is Ray Hill, and you're listening to Execution Watch at executionwatch.org and on KPFT HD2 channel. Thank you for tuning in this evening. It was a very serious business. Tonight is the scheduled execution of Ricardo Ortiz. To make all of this possible, our executive producer, Elizabeth Ann Stein, can be reached at the email address steinea@yahoo.com. Our technical wizard is Otis McClay, who can be reached through this radio station, KPFT. The theme music that just got off was Victoria Panetti, written and performed by her as a special contribution to the issue of executions. Every time Texas does an execution, we come into this studio and go on this broadcast channel in order to give you the history of that case, information about the legal evolution of that case, and stand watch as things are proceeding in Huntsville. In just a few minutes, we'll have a report from Huntsville. Tonight, that's by Kelly Epstein, who is standing watch across the street or near the death chamber in Huntsville. We'll hear from Dave Atwood, who is stationed at the vigil that happens in Houston each time executions occur. And that vigil is at the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd on property belonging to St. Anne's Catholic Church. Jim comes with us from a long friendship with him and a long practice of law. Jim has practiced law both as a prosecutor and as a defense lawyer and has detailed information about it. Right now, I think we have Kelly on the line. Kelly, are you there?
Yes, I am, Ray. How are you?
I am fine. We've got to get the sound balanced here. What's going on in Huntsville?
Well, we saw the media go in about a minute and a half ago. We have not seen any witnesses go across the street yet for Ricardo, although I understand that he had a number of visitors this morning. So we expect them just any minute to go ahead and begin their walk across the street. Apparently the execution is on. There's no more appeals.
For our first-time listeners, when we say the witnesses, first the media witness, then followed by witnesses for Ricardo cross the street, that meant they come from the old...
I'm not able to hear you at all.
Sorry. It meant that they came from the old administration building, escorted by people in public information, across to witness the scheduled event, right? She can't hear me. Okay, Kelly?
Yes.
If anything occurs up there, please get back in touch with us so we will know. If there is a delay on witnesses for Mr. Ortiz, call Elizabeth back on her cell phone so we can report that.
I will do that because usually they would have gone across by now. We have no way of knowing whether or not he's actually got witnesses. Sometimes there are no witnesses for the condemned. So I will wait a few more minutes and give Elizabeth a call if nobody goes in.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Ray. Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Kelly Epstein, and she is in Huntsville observing that. Well, Jim?
Yes.
I don't know whether the appeal court spent a lot of paper on this, but you did. You have a rather detailed analysis of this case.
It's a rather detailed case. It's kind of convoluted. Let me try to explain it carefully and so we'll all understand it. What happened, Ortiz was on parole, And what happened, they arrested him for a parole violation. And the FBI, after they'd arrested him, there were a series of bank robberies that occurred in El Paso. And as soon as Ortiz is arrested by state officials, he tells the state officials, I'm more than willing to give you a lot of information about the current bank robberies you folks are investigating. So what happened, the FBI, they notify the FBI that Ortiz has some information about a series of bank robberies. Well, they had suspected a man by the name of Garcia as being the actual robber. As a matter of fact, they had some eyeball witnesses that identified him as being inside the bank. And they knew somebody had driven the getaway car, and they assumed Ortiz was the one that had driven the getaway car because he said he had information about the robberies, and that was putting everything together.
Okay, Ortiz was out on state parole.
On state parole.
And because there is no federal parole.
Right.
And so he's out on state parole, and he's willing to give up information concerning a federal case
right.
in exchange for favors on his state parole.
Exactly. And so what happened at that point, they had not suspected Ortiz as being one of the robbers. They suspected the guy by the name of Garcia as being one of the robbers. In fact, they had already, as I said, had identification on him from a photographic lineup. So what they did, the FBI dilly-dallied around. By the time they got to the state jail, Ortiz wouldn't cooperate. You know, that apparently upset them. So here's what they did. In fact, the way the opinion reads out of the Fifth Circuit is the FBI concocted, and those are words from the court opinion.
Hmm.
They concocted a scheme, and here's what they did. They picked up Garcia. Didn't have a warrant for him. They picked him up and put him in to question him, and they brought over Ortiz from the jail. Walked Ortiz by the interview room to make certain that Ortiz made eye contact with Garcia so he could see Garcia talking to FBI agents.
But he was there too.
Right, but they wanted Ortiz to believe that that Garcia was snitching him off and telling on him.
And wanted Garcia to believe the same thing.
Exactly. So what happened, they thought they would turn on each other, and at that point Garcia would incriminate Ortiz, and Ortiz would incriminate Garcia. Neither of the two men would talk. So here's the next thing they did, and this is where it gets really, really testy. At that point, the FBI then filed a federal warrant for a bank robbery on Garcia. Now, Ortiz had already, of course, been arrested on the parole violation. When they prepared the probable cause statement, they admit this, they lied and claimed that Ortiz was the informant that led to Garcia's arrest. And when you do these probable cause statements, this means the defense lawyer gets to see them, everybody gets to see them, it's a public record, so
sure.
Then the cat's out of the bag. So what the FBI then does, they call in Ortiz.
But this document is a total fraud.
It's a fraud, not true. And they call in Ortiz and show him the probable cause statement, said, looky, you better watch your back. Because this is a probable cause statement, and Ortiz is going to find out that, or at least believe, you snitched him off. And they did the very same thing to Garcia. They call him in and claim that Ortiz is snitching him off. They still don't talk, even after a fraudulent document. And here's where it really is, I think, pretty bad. At this point, they have a jail cell in El Paso Jail that's it's housed only by people, members of the Texas Syndicate. You either got to be a member of the Texas Syndicate or some association with it.
For you unwashed listeners, Texas Syndicate is a prison gang, actually, that began in California, of Texas inmates housed in California. It has since come home to Texas prison system, and it's a very significant prison gang in Texas, and it spills over wherever dope is exchanged in large quantities, and there are other criminal activities of gang interest. So now an infection that began in California prisons is affecting neighborhoods all over the country, and El Paso is one of those major neighborhoods. It is known that the Texas Syndicate is at war with the Mexican Mafia on kind of a continuous non-stop bases, and this goes on forever and ever. They're Hispanic. One of them is Texas Syndicate, which is basically Chicanos from Texas doing time in prisons all over the world, and the other are people from Mexico who are competing with them for gang space. So with that background, continue, Jim.
And what they did, they had a cell block dedicated to, they segregated the Texas
sure.
Syndicate members. Well, the person in charge of that cell block was Ortiz. place.
He's a capo.
He was the capo. He was the head. And in fact, they said he was the highest ranking member of the Texas Syndicate, at least in jail and implied even in El Paso. And what they did during the trial, they had testimony that not only was he in charge of the jail cell itself, he was in charge of who got commissary. He was in charge of who got favors. He was the go-between between the inmates and the inmates and the jailers. He was the go-between between problems with the inmates.
Let me do a little explanation here. What you're talking about is the building tender system.
Right, same thing. Building tender.
And the jail authorities actually sanctioned the advantages enjoyed by some inmates by controlling other inmates. And if you've got a jail cell full of Texas Syndicate inmates, then the ranking member of the Texas Syndicate is the person in the culture of the gang, rises to the top, and everybody else takes orders from him. That happens in the jail, and apparently in El Paso at this time, the El Paso jail authorities were enfranchising
right.
Ortiz to do this.
And so what happened, knowing well in advance that Ortiz was in charge of that jail cell, knowing they had implied and led Ortiz to believe that the snitch was coming to his jail, they put the snitch inside the jail, Garcia. Put him in the same jail cell with him, same block, same everything.
Same block, yeah.
Within 2 or 3 days, he's dead of an overdose of heroin. And here's what the evidence broke down at trial. And here's where it gets even, I think, even more peculiar. Not peculiar, it just seems awful bad. What happened, one inmate claims that he actually saw Ortiz being shot. He actually forced him, Garcia, to shoot him with heroin. Here's what he claims. He claims that Ortiz had some heroin smuggled in through a jail visit. He claims that he was sitting in the day room, and he said Ortiz and two other inmates called Garcia back to a cell. He claims from his position in the day room he could see inside the cell. He claimed that he saw them getting a spoon, cooking up the heroin, and they saw him shooting up, him being Ortiz, shooting up Garcia, and they said it looked like it was involuntary. Garcia didn't want to be shot up. As soon as he was shot up, he began to react like he was overdosing. And at that point, he claims that he died, and that he claimed he actually witnessed it.
Didn't the autopsy report say there was no significant crack marks?
Here's what the autopsy report indicated. There was one needle mark indicating he had been shot up one time, but no track marks indicating that Garcia was not a heroin addict. This was a first time shot, at least in jail. And he had 3 times the normal dose of heroin is what killed him. And so that was one eyeball witness to it. Then we had a second witness in jail who also claimed that he knew both of these men, knew them prior to going to jail. And he said he had been recruited by Ortiz to be a member of the Texas Syndicate. He said that during all of this transaction that he heard Ortiz say on several occasions he was going to kill Garcia because Garcia was going to snitch him off on some bank robberies. Initially, he claims Ortiz was going to stab him to death. And then he decided the best way to do it was to kill him with an overdose of heroin. And he claimed the night before the death occurred that the heroin was delivered to the jail on a jail visit. And in fact, several of them got high that night. And he claimed he was not present when Ortiz shot up Garcia. But after it was over, he claimed that all of them shared what was left of the heroin. All of them got high again. As a matter of fact, both state witnesses admitted to be heroin addicts. Both of them admitted taking heroin at the same time that Garcia was killed. And both of them were high on heroin. Now, the big flap on the second witness was he initially claimed he had a deal cut with the state to testify in the state's behalf, and then later reneged on that. With the first witness, there were some problems with his credibility, because initially when they had a diagram drawing showing where he was seated during the transaction, he couldn't even see inside the jail cell. And he later claimed that diagram was something he had not prepared and he was mistaken. And they later introduced a photograph claiming he was sitting in a position where he could actually see inside the jail cell. Then after they had two...
Is there a credible witness in this case anywhere?
All of them were on heroin. Every one of them had shot heroin that night. One of them claimed to have seen it, then got confused on where he was on a diagram. The other one claims he did not see it, but claimed that Ortiz had made an admission to him that he, in fact, was going to do the killing and did do the killing. He made that admission. And he claimed he also had a deal with the state. Then how they followed that up, they followed it up with testimony from, and this is what really I found most disturbing, at least from a law viewpoint. They called a gang expert, and basically they went through the entire background, Ortiz's background, and they basically gave him the death penalty because he was a member of a gang. And the reason I find that somewhat offensive is because supposedly when you go to jail, you pay your debt to society. And they're not supposed to be in one of the fundamental tenets of law. You cannot try somebody by showing they have bad character and showing they're acting in conformity with that particular character. You can't bring up their past just to kill them because of their past. That's basically what they did in this case. Because their witnesses were very, very questionable. They had, like I say, they were all inmates in jail. All of them were heroin addicts. All of them had some reason to get in curry favor with the state. And what's interesting, the man who died, Garcia, had a history of wanting to commit suicide. And that was the defensive theory. In fact, he had been in and out. Apparently, if you look at this, El Paso's jail was kind of like his second home. He was in and out. And every time they went in, they'd have little
checks. We called them frequent flyers.
Yeah, he was like a turntable. And he went in like they had four or five different admission deals where he was in earlier. And on several of those admission forms, they had him down as a possible suicide risk. His girlfriend testified that he said, at the age of 15, he was threatened to commit suicide and told his girlfriend, if I ever go back to jail, I'll commit suicide. Had a doctor who testified from medical records that he threatened to commit suicide if he ever went back to jail again. And of course, the defensive theory was that perhaps Ortiz might have smuggled heroin in, because then if he's in charge of the cell, he probably had something to do with the heroin coming in. Question in, was this a deliberate act or was it an accidental overdose? That's really the big issue in this particular case.
And apparently a jury didn't buy that.
Not after, see, and you're probably not familiar with El Paso juries. I went out there about 4 or 5 years ago, and I defended a young man that was longer than that. It was back during Desert Storm. Some GI, there's a bunch of GIs. In fact, my client was a drunk Irishman, killed 3 guys in a drunken accident. So I picked a jury and spent about 3 months in El Paso. And El Paso, strange enough, is a very, very conservative town. The people there, the Hispanic population is pretty well cowed. They pretty well go with what the state wants. And I was kind of surprised because I'm used to the Rio Grande Valley bunch. You're kind of rambunctious. Man, not in El Paso. They got them whipped in shape over there. And, believe me, they march kind of the tune of like Adolf Hitler's band. It's amazing. They're real conservative there. And when that jury found out about all the gang stuff, and there's that funny, peculiar thing, and a lot of people, especially when you have emerging minority groups and you have minority groups on juries, they get pretty outraged. For example, the worst juror you can have is a minority who's a member of the establishment, like a post office person that's an African American. They will be horrible to other African Americans because I think it reflects upon their race, so to speak. So when you have a jury that's predominantly Hispanic, and you have a guy that's a gang member that has all those bad things that people oftentimes associate with Hispanic people, they sometimes overreact.
How admissible is all that evidence?
Well, theoretically, it's only supposed to be admissible to show motive. Usually, if you've got some motive to bring what we call extraneous offenses, it can come in. But there was there's no reason to show motive in this case. I mean, they had some bizarre things in the Court of Criminal Appeals. They said the reason it was admissible because the jury needed to know why they had a separate tank for the Texas Centagon. Well, that has nothing to do with the murder while they had a separate tank. Basically, they tried this guy because he was a gang member. And I think that's the reason they gave him the death penalty. Because the truth of the matter is, the killing is set up by the FBI. If there was a such thing, if you really want to be fair about this, they should indict the FBI. They set the killing up. It's a killing by the FBI.
Well, I mean, we've got every indication from the appellate record. You've got a bunch of dope fiends, heroin addicts, which are, a very serious class of dope fiend. And you have the victim is suicidal. Everybody's involved in some kind of dope smuggling into the jail or bank robbery. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on here. And then you've got, isn't the FBI somehow culpable?
You would think so, but here's what's funny, Ray. You and I apparently the only ones that were alarmed about this, because I read this case last night. I kept thinking, why in the world didn't this come up on some issue on appeal? It was never, ever mentioned as any point of error about the culpability of the FBI.
How did you find it out?
It was all written in the opinions. Everything that I wrote and sent you directly
came
out of
from out of a judge.
Well, it came from the way it works. Whenever there's testimony, a court reporter transcribes that.
Uh-huh.
That's called a statement of facts, and it's literally a question and answer form like a deposition.
So the appellate courts knew this. It just didn't.
Well, what happens when you do the statement of facts, they will have a summary of the facts. And what the lawyers do that write the appellate briefs, they read the summary of the facts, and they find errors after reading the summary of facts. There's no error ever alleged on the misconduct on the part of the lawyer, of the FBI. It was just simply a part of the case. It was just not kind of like stuck in there as a part of the facts. There's no question of what happened.
If you and I did the exactly same thing, we're not cops. If we did exactly the same, wouldn't we be culpable?
The definition of a party is really simple. If you do something to aid or assist another to commit a crime, and it's
foreseeable.
That can
be encouraging and setting it up. And
let me give you an example. The classic example of parties occurred a number of years ago when there was an astronomer who had gone out on the Southwest Freeway, and he was going to do some type of studying of stars and had a flat tire. A group of kids stopped to help him, and it was real late at night. And going back in, they helped him pick up his tires. His spare was flat, so they drove him into town. He got got his tire fixed, and they watched him when he paid for the tire, and he had quite a bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided to rob him. And they all agreed to do the robbery. So what happened, they take him back out to his car, and they rob him. After they rob him, one of the guys go back and shoots him in the head and kills him.
Mm.
They charge the other people with murder. And the reason they charge him with murder, they said since you planned a robbery and it was foreseeable that someone could be shot because you knew a gun was involved, you could also be guilty of murder. Well, the FBI knew, number one, that this guy Ortiz was the head of this tank. They knew he was a member of the Texas Syndicate. They're the ones that planted the seed that the man he killed was a snitch. And it was not true. He was not a snitch.
We're going to develop the law of parties here involving the FBI in just a second. We've got a report from Kelly Epstein in Huntsville. Kelly, what have you to report?
Well, this is a very quick execution, one of the quickest I can remember. The media came out just about 20 minutes after they went in. There were no witnesses for Ricardo. Women showed up, one his spiritual advisor and the other one who didn't want to, say anything. But after the media came out and she knew that the execution had taken place, she just broke down and just, was just having a very, very hard time.
Who was the spiritual?
They left immediately. There wasn't anything to say to comfort her.
Who was the spiritual advisor?
She didn't give her name and she wouldn't, They kept to themselves, Ray. I think they had a lot. They had visited Ricardo in the morning with a large number of other people, a lot of relatives, and we don't know why there were no witnesses for him.
Could have been at his request.
It could have been at his request. We just don't know.
How many other have joined you at the vigil?
There were five other people, three people from Germany, and then three of us local.
And I'm sure it's fresh up in Huntsville, so get into the warmth.
It's not as cold as it was last night, Ray.
And are you with any organization, Kelly?
Pardon me?
Are you with any organization?
Of course I'm with TCADP, and then also a member of Pax Christi.
Oh, Pax Christi. How can people learn about Pax Christi?
They can go to Pax Christi's website.
Okay, just Google Pax Christi. That's P-A-X-C-H...
www.paxchristi.org, I believe.
Okay, that's P-A-X-C-H-R-I-S-T-I.
Uh-huh.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Ray.
And appreciate you being on the program, Kelly, even though we didn't have good news tonight.
Good night.
And that was Kelly Epstein. We need to inform Dave now as Elizabeth goes to make all of these connections. We keep people advised here on Execution Watch. So, under normal circumstances, if they had not been some kind of cops, what the FBI did would literally fall under the definition of the law of party.
Absolutely. I mean, how can you not, if you were a policeman and you literally set up a deal and lied to make somebody believe somebody's an informant, and then you put that person you've named as an informant inside of a tank. Why do you think they put in search warrants? They never name the person because they're afraid that when they get an informant and a search warrant, they never name him because of fear of retaliation. This is about as common as a Pope being a Catholic. And then they set up a scenario in which they lead both people to believe that one's an informant, and they put the informant in the very tank with the person that he's going to inform.
They don't merely say that, to kind of drive that home.
They drove it home by making a false affidavit. They admitted that. They admitted when that they issued the arrest warrant for the man who was killed. They admitted they were not telling the truth when they put in that affidavit that the man who was killed was an informant against Ortiz.
If I guess with the execution of Mr. Ortiz, these issues are dead.
No, they are. Well, yeah.
Can these issues be raised about the conspiracy?
I've often wondered why a family wouldn't bring a lawsuit. It seems to me that it the same thing as a wrongful death.
But now, what are you talking about, Mr. Garcia?
I'm talking about the family. I'm talking about the
Ortiz family.
Ortiz family.
Either family could bring this. Dave?
Yeah.
We're sitting here talking about the conspiracy engaged in by the FBI in this case. We're sad to report that the witnesses, the media witnesses, were all there were in Huntsville, and they have now come out, meaning the process is through, but there's still lingering issues in this case. Are you familiar with this case?
I've read a little bit about it, Ray.
And because apparently the FBI went to great lengths to set both the victim and the perpetrator up to think they were snitching on one another.
Oh, wow.
And then the jail had them in the same tank, which was actually owned and operated by the perpetrator. In this case, it was a Texas Syndicate prison gang tank.
Uh-huh.
And so the FBI knew or should have known that by setting these folks up thinking they were snitching on one another, that something dangerous could happen, but made no preparations to protect anybody.
Wow.
How many folks joined you tonight?
We had 7 people out tonight. We had a better turnout tonight than we did yesterday. I put out an appeal and cried over the internet. So some people came. We had a good turnout, actually. And we did our part as best we could. And but I didn't know all those details on the case, Ray, that you're talking about. So.
Well, when you get home tonight, go to the internet and catch this case on the archive, because Jim has brought us just a wealth of confusing information.
Yeah,
and the website is executionwatch.org.
Okay, I'll do that. Yeah.
Now you're located again tonight at St. Anne's.
Right, we're at the St. Anne's, the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd. And like I said before, this is always a good corner from the perspective of we have literally hundreds of cars come by on Westheimer and Shepherd. It's just extremely busy. And so I always feel like it's a good impact on people to see us out there. And we get a lot of encouragement, really, from the people. Very few people now say anything negative to us. It used to be that we'd get a lot of, you know, negative comments, but that doesn't happen anymore.
Do you expect...
It's indicative of people changing.
Do you expect to be there on February the 4th whenever David Martinez is scheduled?
Yes, yes, we'll be there. We'll be at this... At this spot, we will be here for January, February, and March.
Is
that'll change to another place for the next 3 months. That's how it's set up right now.
Is there convenient parking nearby?
There is. There's a church parking lot right there that we can park in. And so it works out real good for people. And if they don't want to park there, they can go across the street. There's a shopping center here you can park in also.
And what time do you gather?
5:30.
5:30, and there's a nearby place where you can get a warm cup of coffee if you need one.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, so we really encourage people to come out. You know, it really, the more you have, obviously, the better it looks. It doesn't look good. We had three last night. It's better than nothing, but at the same time, you want more than three people.
Dave, so, how do people get in touch with you organizationally?
Well, I think probably the best way would be to go to the Texas Coalition website, because they can get a hold of me that way via email. If they go to tcadp.org, www.tcadp.org, they can connect up with me that way. And we list all the vigils around the state. And, you know, what we do here in Houston is one of, I think we're doing it about, right now, Ray, I think we have it in about 8 or 10 different places. Or we have it in Dallas and, you know, in cities, San Antonio,
sure.
Austin. They have it up in College Station. They have a vigil up there. And we have it, I think there's a group that gets together up in Lubbock now every time, and down in the valley. So we've got a lot of places where we're doing this. And and all about that on the website.
And all of that is on the website. Are there any other events scheduled other than these vigils?
For surrounding the execution?
Right. I mean, is there a lobby day scheduled for this session?
Oh, well, there's going to be lobby days, because there's there's two bills for abolition of the death penalty that have been introduced right now, plus some other bills just for to restrict the death penalty. And then the next event we're going to have here in Houston, though, is on March 12th at the Rothko Chapel. We're having this author, Tom Cahill, sort of went out of his style of books and has written a book called Saint on Death Row, A Saint on Death Row. It's about Dominique Green,
uh-huh.
who I used to visit a lot. He's going to be at the Rothko Chapel on Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, or on, I don't know if it's Wednesday, on March 12th at 7 o'clock. And that's the next event that I know that's going on in Houston.
Okay, that's this coming Wednesday at 7 o'clock at Rothko.
No, March 12th.
March 12th. March 12th, a Wednesday at Rothko Chapel.
Right.
Dave, how can people get in touch with your book, Detour to Execution?
Well, again, the best way, it's on the Texas Coalition website, which is the tcadp.org. They can go there and order it through that website. It actually ends up going to Amazon. Anybody can go to Amazon directly and get it that way. Did you get your copy?
Yes, I've got my copy at home.
Okay.
Now, Dave, thank you for the signature. David, the other thing I want to ask is... do you not have a Senate sponsor for the bills?
No, as of right now, I have not heard. There's a couple that are very close to coming on, but I don't think they have as of right now. We have, let's see, Harold Dutton has introduced an abolition bill.
Jessica Farrar has one in the Hooper.
And Jessica Farrar.
Yeah.
Those two have put in abolition bills. And there's a couple of senators that have, I don't know, they're just so close to doing it. They're for it, but I guess politically they don't think they've got the stroke for it right now. And so they haven't done it.
Do you have House Speed? Keith.
Dave?
Yeah.
Give our regards to those at Vigil with you.
Okay, I sure will.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you, Ray.
And that was Dave Atwood at the Texas Coalition to Abolish the or Texas Coalition Against Death Penalty. We're going to go for another guest on tonight's program, Jim. During that segue, there's a lot to this case.
Let me tell you another thing that I found real troubling, and I hate intellectual dishonesty. The reason this was a capital murder, there is a provision that says if you kill somebody on the account of their service or status as a witness, that elevates it to capital murder. Now, here's what's real interesting about this. Both men, neither one had ever admitted that they were going to ever admitted that the other person committed the bank robberies. Both of them had Fifth Amendment claims. Had they gone to trial on this bank robbery case, Ortiz could not have been a witness against Garcia, and Garcia could not have been a witness against Ortiz because both of them had Fifth Amendment privileges. Number two, neither man ever admitted that the other person was involved. So, and there's a real question whether or not there's such a thing. And this is what really bothered me with the court. And here's what they said, and I found this real, and this to me is intellectually dishonest. They said you can be a witness if, number one, you helped commit a crime. Well, they only have accusations from some witnesses who saw them together that they committed the crime. You can be a prospective witness, or if you viewed the crime, or if the person committed the crime told you he did it. This is enough to make you...
None of those things are true of these two men.
That's exactly right. And here's what they said. They said that that's the status of a witness. If you, number one, are involved in the crime... Well, see, neither man admitted, incriminated the other. The only one that incriminated them were other witnesses. Number two, they said if you can be, you can have a status of witness if you actually had someone confess to you. They never admitted that. And number three, you can be have your status as a witness if you saw it committed. That was never proven. And that's what elevated this to a capital murder case. Had it not been for their status as a witness, it would never have been a capital case. I think that was intellectually dishonest of the courts, and that really bothered me. And that was argued, but they just simply flushed the argument.
Well, hold that thought, because we're definitely going to come back to that. The whole rationale for this execution tonight may have been a fraudulent piece of imagination in the minds of FBI agents. Think about that while we talk to Mr. Hadayati. Mr. Hadayati,
yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, Human Hadayati is joining us. From where are you, Mr. Hadayati?
I'm in Austin, Texas.
You're in Austin, Texas, you've been involved in execution work at what level?
Yes, I'm with this group called Students Against the Death Penalty. Which is, we have a Texas chapter, Texas Students Against the Death Penalty, and we're a statewide and a national group of students in different universities and some high schools working against to stop executions.
Yeah, I've seen folks with banners over at the University of Houston, so you're networked in with all of them.
That's right.
Okay, and how does the student organization, what are you able to do? Do you hold teach-ins? Do you hold seminars? What do you do?
Yeah, well, basically our group helps different students in their colleges and campuses. If they need the speakers to go there, if they need help with research, if they like to learn more, we help them with anything possible by sending the speakers, helping them to organize panels, movie screenings, and so on. And one of our main projects that we do, it's a major project, is the annual Alternative Spring Break to stop executions. And that's our main event that we bring a group of college students from around the country and Texas. For the last few years, we've been bringing them to Austin. And it's a one full-week program where we train them on the death penalty issues. We have murder victim family members to talk. We have exonerated death row inmates that come and talk. And that's basically the main training event we have. We train them, and then we send them back to their schools to start new student chapters or improve the ones that might already exist.
Sound like you're trying to build a movement.
Basically. Well, what we thought was that the death penalty movement lacking the student activists, unlike other movements like environmental movements. This is the kind of issues that not a lot of students are. It's a really emotional issue and something that not a lot of them know about and something that not everybody wants to become involved with. So that's why we started this group to help and solve that problem.
And what is your field of study? What is your major?
I am a senior year government major student.
Uh-huh.
I am graduating this May, hopefully.
And what do you plan to do with those degrees?
Well, hopefully I'll work for 1 or 2 years and then apply to law school.
Okay, so you're going to get to law school by way of government as opposed to the other way around.
Yes.
Well, listen, will you please keep us informed here at Execution Watch about your planned activities? Do you have anything now on the schedule?
Sure. Well, basically what we have this year, our alternative spring break that we have is this year is from March 16 to 20. And this year we moved our spring break to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And we are helping this group in North Carolina to start a similar program in their state. And what our group in Texas is offering is we are, in order to help Texas students to go to participate in that alternative spring break, we are offering a few free airfare flight tickets for young people from Texas to travel to North Carolina. And anybody that's interested, they can go to springbreakalternative.org to register and find more information.
Okay, springbreakalternative.org, and the event's going to be in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And what are the dates again?
March 16 to 20.
Right, and also Otis tells me there's a link on executionwatch.org to the spring break.
Okay, there's a link on our website to your website so people can find it easily at executionwatch.org. Listen, good luck with that work. And while you're over in Chapel Hill, they named a street after me. I knew the mayor over there at one point.
And, really?
And he liked my brand of activism. And so there is a Ray Hill Street. It's only about 4 blocks long, but, and it's way
out. I'll make sure to stop by there.
It's way out in the boonies. If you see any, dogs pissing on my, on my yard sign, tell them to move along.
Sure.
Thank you very much for joining
Thank
us.
You.
Bye bye. And that was Hunan Hadayati, Hunan Hadayati at University of Texas, a young activist involved in students against the death penalty, students against capital punishment. And go to our website and link on to his website and find out about that. Jim.
Yeah.
Your report has been alarming.
Let me tell you what's even more bizarre. But go back to that deal earlier about what the definition of a witness is. Let me read the statute specifically what it says. It's a capital murder if you retaliate against a person on their status or service as a witness or prospective witness. Now, here's what's interesting. There never was any testimony that Ortiz was ever involved in these bank robberies, ever. Now, you had some independent testimony that Garcia, the guy ended up dying, that he was involved. He was identified by one of the clerks, and his girlfriend testified at trial that he was involved in some bank robberies. Both of them had Fifth Amendment claims. There were no bank robberies charge ever filed against Ortiz, ever.
Ever.
Ever. No. And the only warrant filed...
And they didn't have sufficient evidence to file any against Garcia.
Well, the affidavit against Garcia had false information in it claiming that the snitch was, in fact, Ortiz, and Ortiz had never, ever incriminated him. There was no evidence ever that Ortiz was a witness on anything involving bank robberies. He never admitted it, and no one ever identified him. But yet, they executed him because they're claiming he executed a witness in a bank robber case that he was never filed on for. That's what's bizarre about this case, because they're accusing him of killing somebody who could be a witness against him in a bank robbery when they didn't have sufficient information to charge him with bank robbery to begin with, and the witness supposedly killed couldn't have testified anyway because he had a Fifth Amendment claim. There's no sure a jury would leave him anyway, because a guy that was going to testify against him had been in and out of jail, was a heroin addict, was a gang member, and I'm not even sure the state would ever have used him as a witness. But they glossed over that, and they just simply said if there's a possibility of that person being a witness, that qualifies for a death penalty. And that's why it became a death penalty case as opposed to a straight murder case, because of Ortiz's status as being a defendant in a case he wasn't named in, and the guy he killed supposedly going to be a witness when he had never testified against him, never made a statement against
him. Is there any indication these issues were raised in the trial?
They argued it. They argued that part at the trial level. They argued that evidence was legally insufficient to make this a capital murder case. And that's when our Court of Criminal Appeals said there's a possibility. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. There's a possibility, since Ortiz's girlfriend said he was involved in robberies, and since Ortiz had been named by one of the bank tellers, or identified by one of the bank tellers, this means Ortiz could have been a witness in a robbery case.
A robbery case
of a bank. But no one ever identified Ortiz as being the other robber. The fact that we're witnesses against each other was fabricated by the FBI.
By the FBI, that was totally
fabricated. FBI fabricated that. Because what they basically did was fabricated witnesses, then executed one for killing a fabricated witness. It's what they basically did, and set it up.
Well, now, all of this...
And that's exactly what they did, Ray. They set all this up.
This is the only case ever that these issues are a part of, but there haven't been subsequent litigation or case law that they're developing. This is amazing. Because,
well, it's a fabricated, the whole deal of them being witnesses against each other, fabricated by the FBI.
That's a part of the record.
Right.
We know that.
Yeah.
Across the street, you may want to run across. They're towing it. Thanks.
What? I don't know what's going on here.
They're towing a car across the street.
Okay.
Somebody. We got towed away. Somebody
are you parked across the street? Okay, I didn't think so.
Anyway, like I'm saying, this is what bothers me, because I think that's intellectually dishonest to fabricate a witness when that doesn't exist. And it could possibly be true, but there's no basis for it.
But, Jim, that's not even rare.
I mean,
these are FBI agents in this case, but Houston cops pull tricks like that all the time.
Let me tell you an interesting case. At least our state courts are a little bit, perhaps, more, give you a good example. The Bexar County Court of the San Antonio Court of Appeals here about a month ago had a real, real interesting case. They had a man they were accusing of murder.
Mm-hmm.
And to try to get him to confess, they phonied up an offense report. They took a regular offense report and bleeded it out and made it appear as though the offense report said that his fingerprints were found on the murder weapon, which was a fabrication.
Mm-hmm.
Simply not true. So what happened, they showed him this phonied up offense report showing that, they said, look at what we've got here. We've got fingerprint evidence, your fingerprints on this piece of paper. We got proof that your fingerprints were on this piece of paper, on this weapon. So he confesses once he thinks his fingerprints are on the murder weapon. They reverse that confession, because here's what they said. When you fabricate an offense report, use that in an official proceeding, that violates a statute. And our exclusionary rule says that any evidence gained in violation of the law can't be used against a person. They kick the confession out. What's interesting, had they verbally told him that, and not put it in writing, the confession would have been admissible.
Uh-huh.
So at least our courts, at least a little more cranky about police conduct like this. But in this case, I kept reading this case, and it's one case where they fabricate witnesses and execute somebody for killing a fabricated witness. And it could all be true. They could all both be guilty of the bank robberies. There's no question about that.
That could be true.
Could be true. But it sure wasn't proven in this case.
But isn't there a requirement that each element be proven up?
All they had to prove that there was a possibility that Ortiz could have been charged with bank robbery, And there is a possibility that had he been charged with bank robbery, and had Garcia lived long enough, he could have and perhaps would have testified in this mythical case that didn't exist yet. And they never filed, to my knowledge, they never filed a bank robbery case on Ortiz. At least the record doesn't indicate that. And that's what I found real alarming, at least about the so-called reasoning of the court.
Ortiz was in jail for a parole violation.
Parole violation, right. The way that he got involved in this, he was the one that claimed that he had knowledge. They weren't aware of him. They had no knowledge prior to him going to jail or being involved in any robberies. As soon as he hits the jail on his parole violation, he says, I have information about these robberies, if you will help me.
But as far as we know, he didn't identify anybody.
Didn't know. And so based on that.
Well, he didn't want to give that information up until he got something back about his parole.
Exactly. And so what happened, based upon that, he tries to cut a deal with the FBI, and they assume that Ortiz is the driver, the getaway driver they've been looking for. No one ever identified him as being the getaway driver. Garcia never identified him as a getaway driver, and nobody
at the
bank
ain't giving up nothing.
No, and he didn't give up anything. And the only claim that Garcia was incriminating Ortiz was all fabricated by the FBI. That's what I'm saying. The whole thing is just bizarre. The reasoning, this is one of those things that's intellectually dishonest. And again, I find it somewhat offensive. I'm not saying he's a great guy that should be.
We don't have any. We don't have any angels here. But what we do have here is a person who is now dead.
Yes.
The state of Texas has laid him on the gurney, has placed needles in his arm, and he has been executed before witnesses. We don't know if there were any witnesses on the other side, but you can read about this in the newspaper tomorrow. And the part of the story that is not going to be in the newspaper for tomorrow is the part of the story that Jim and I are discussing right now. That the whole thing was basically set up by the FBI fabricated documents trying to intimidate people to testify against each other. That never happened.
Exactly. You're exactly right. Because the FBI was the one that dreamed. In fact, when I say the word concocted, that is a direct quotation out of the Fifth Circuit. That's the language that the courts use. They concocted a scheme, and that's exactly what they did.
Yet none of these judges, I'm talking about trial court judge, I'm talking about district court of appeals, I'm talking about Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, I'm talking about the federal court system, presumably all the way up to an application to the Supreme Court, which they denied cert.
Thus far, to my knowledge, only five people are concerned about it, and they're all in this studio right now tonight. It's you and me and three people in the audience. Otherwise, no one but you and me have talked about it.
I think this is absolutely amazing. And so the three people out there in the audience, plus we have a peanut gallery tonight. We don't normally.
We're the only ones,
Ray. We have seven people out there on the internet, no telling how many listen to HD.
Well, I forgot Otis. We got six that are shocked about this, too. I don't know if Otis is shocked.
Otis said he didn't care.
Otis didn't care. I'm just telling him, I read this stuff, I kept thinking, my God, this is, if it wasn't a man's life involved. And again, I go back to what I said before, I find it terribly, terribly offensive that you can never, we will not let people forget their past when they try to change. And that seems to me so terribly wrong, because supposedly we're a Christian country, supposedly. We're supposed to forgive and help. And when people get in trouble, when they get in like gangs and young people, and they do, I thank God I'm not being tried in my old age for the crimes of my youth. No, I didn't get caught.
Right. Aren't we
and,
all?
You know,
we got a unanimous vote on
and
that.
And the truth of the matter is, they executed this man because he was a member of a prison gang. That's why they killed him.
That's right.
And they execute him because of his status, not because of the act he did, because of his status. And that's what they did. And that's wrong. If you're gonna,
I've got an old convict here in the peanut gallery. You just come up to the microphone, Grunstrom.
He gets writing his damn notes. Just say something, Dan.
I'm wondering, did you think the appeal court that was the basis that they affirmed it on, the fact that he was a gang member, too?
Clearly.
Sure, of course.
Clearly. Of all the judges that looked at this case, learned men and women of the profession, lawyers all, trained, elected or appointed to positions, approved for those appointments, looked at this case and missed the obvious.
Well, Jim, you know, back in the old days when Hoover was there with the FBI, if you had said what you had said tonight and Ray had said what he had said tonight, that would have been your car that they were hauling off after.
Well, it may be my car, but Otis over here has got something to say.
The thing that Jim was saying about intellectual dishonesty is so true, and the scary thing is, no, believe me, I'm on mic. The scary thing is that they don't care. That they're intellectually dishonest, that the system doesn't care, and that's one of the major problems we have now, is this, that the law behaves this way, and people know what it's doing, and assume that the law is totally corrupt.
Let me go a step further with that. Let me go back a step further. We disguise these things in neat little phrases. Years ago, we had a thing called the good faith exception to search warrant requirements.
Sure.
What it basically said was, if a policeman and a judge cannot read and write the English language, if they're illiterate, we're going to protect them. They literally, when they had the Leon case and the Shepherd case that came out of the Supreme Court back in the early 60s. And this is real simple. The case involved a murder case, and they got a search warrant, a pre-printed form for a drug case to look for murder weapons. You can read. It said the warrant said drugs. It'd be like me sending you to the store for apples, and you come back with a Fram filter.
Yeah.
Same thing. And they're saying as long as they're acting in good faith, which is a really protection of illiteracy. Just recently, we had the Supreme Court this past week affirmed a case when they forgot to take off the computer, the fact that a warrant had been recalled. And they said that's permissible because the negligence is okay. In other words, they're protecting ignorance, and they're propagating ignorance.
Well, you know, we're obviously in two different statuses in this country. There are us, and then there are the cops and the professionals on that side of the bar, and they all enjoy more protection than we do. And the only way that any of this is ever exposed is for the voters to figure it out and replace Harris County Sheriff and replace the President of the United States by total party rejection. But let me tell you, what concerns me is Mr. Ortiz was killed.
Yes.
Mr. Ortiz is out of this argument, and because he is now dead, unless his family wants to bring a wrongful death suit and get these issues heard in a civil court where the penalty is money.
Right.
That the perpetrators who set the crime up encourage the crime to happen. And for all we know, help supply the heroin that did the killing.
Exactly.
That's not unreasonable because cops have access to heroin.
And then the papers didn't pick it up. I'm surprised some newspaper wasn't outraged when they read this. I read the case last night, and I kept thinking, this can't be real. And I read the reasoning of the judges, and I read what happened. I thought, this is a fairy tale, and I'm surprised newspapers didn't pick it up. Like I say, as far as I know, there's about seven of us concerned about it. I don't know.
My name is Ray Hill. You're listening to Execution Watch. You're listening to it on executionwatch.org or on KPFT HD Channel 2. Jim Skelton has been our legal expert tonight and has opened up a can of worms that has us all concerned here. It would not be possible to do this if it had not been for our executive producer, Elizabeth Ann Stein, running the traps to make sure everything is available as we need it. We want to thank Kelly Epstein for her report from Huntsville. We want to thank Dave Atwood for his report from the Houston Vigil, and Hunan Hadayati, who is a student at University of Texas. We wish him Godspeed in his work. All of the technical issues were resolved by technical director Otis McClay, who can be reached at this radio station, and the theme music, Death by Texas, was written and performed by Victoria Panetti. I am Ray Hill. Good night.
Fresh out of the service, it was back in '82.